Hi everyone, Drew Prode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. In today's episode, we're interviewing my dear friend Chris Kresser about how to take a step-by-step approach to personalize your diet. Super fascinating conversation. Can't wait for you to listen. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Prode. Each week, my team and I welcome a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is my dear friend, Chris Kresser, who is kindly letting us use his office space for recording this interview. Chris Kresser is the CEO of the Kresser Institute for Functional and Evolutionary Medicine, the co-director of the California Center for Functional Medicine, and the creator of ChrisKresser.com. He's also the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Cure. He's known for his in-depth research uncovering the myths and misconceptions in modern medicine and providing natural health solutions with proven results. Chris was named one of the 100 most influential people in health and fitness by greatest.com, and his blog is one of the top-ranked natural health websites in the world. He recently launched the Kresser Institute, an organization dedicated to reinventing healthcare and reversing chronic disease by training healthcare practitioners in functional evolutionary medicine, and now coaches as well too. Chris lives here in Berkeley, California, where we're shooting with his wife and daughter. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Drew. Pleasure to have you in my office.
Yes, a pleasure to be here in your office. And why I wanted to come and talk with you, you know, you just finished recording an episode with Dr. Mark Hyman that should actually be live a couple weeks before this episode comes out. And one thing I always remember Mark saying is that Chris is the guy that all the other doctors go to when they're trying to find the real deal when it comes to best practices and evidence-based approaches. And I think that's your reputation in the industry, and not just doctors, but I know myself, my sister who also works with Dr. Mark Hyman, and many of our friends, one of the first things we'll do is we'll take a topic that we're interested in and just add Chris Kresser to the end of it to see if you've blogged about it before. I'm sure that's not the first time you've heard
about
it.
Well, thank you. I'm flattered, and I'm glad that my work can be of service.
Yeah, absolutely. You and your team are doing great stuff. And really where we want to focus this interview is really around the title, around personalization. In this day and age, I don't think that the debates around nutrition and food and what to eat, every year when I think it can't get any crazier, it gets crazier. And you are no novice to that world. In fact, you've probably been on some of the top podcasts in the world. In fact, you've been on the most popular podcast in the world having a debate about what the right diet is for people and what we should be eating and what works and what doesn't work. And I think that from your unique background and the experience in functional medicine and the other evolutionary medicine that's out there, you have a unique perspective on it. So I'd love to just start off big picture. There are people that are out there that do believe that there's a single diet type of diet that's right for every human being. Sometimes they even refer to it as a species-specific diet. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that idea?
I think it's demonstrably false, but with a caveat. So I think the phrase species-appropriate diet does have some validity to it, because there are certain foods that human beings as a species are very well adapted to overall, right? So for, you know, 2 million years, we've been eating primarily meat and fish, fruits, wild fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and some starchy plants. Those have comprised the basic human diet in various proportions, depending on where you are and what groups you're looking at, for 2 million years. Okay, so we know that we're pretty well adapted to eating those kinds of foods. We are not well adapted to eating cheese doodles and drinking Big Gulp and all kinds of other processed and refined foods. So I think it is possible to make some general statements about what is appropriate for human beings in general. However, from that general starting place, there is a lot of room for individualization and customization, because although we share a lot in common as human beings, we're also quite different. We have different genes, different gene expression, different health status, different goals. So if you imagine a sedentary office worker, for example, who is 60 pounds overweight and has type 2 diabetes, that person clearly has different nutritional requirements than perhaps an Olympic athlete training for their next competition who's lean and trying to build muscle and optimize their performance. But unfortunately, that gets lost in the debate or discussion about what the best diet is. And, you know, some people might recommend a ketogenic or a low carb diet for both of those people. I think most Olympic athletes will tell you if they're training, you know, 8 hours a day, that a ketogenic diet or a low carb diet is simply not going to cut it. It's not going to work. They're not going to be able to even compete at the level that they need to. But there are many more examples. You know, women with hypothyroidism may not do well on a ketogenic or a low carb diet. And I'm sure we can go into more detail later. But the main point is that there are some commonalities, I think, that we can point to for human diet. But beyond that, the key to success actually is personalizing it to meet your needs.
And when you think about personalization on a broad picture, and you know, this is not just based on your research, but you were sitting here at the California Center for Functional Medicine, where you and some of the doctors that work with you and practitioners, you see patients. So you're mm-hmm. implementing this. So when you think about all the elements that go into personalization, what goes into that pot when you're thinking about how to personalize specifically diet for somebody?
I think it goes back to what the goal is. So if a patient is coming to see me in the clinic, they're coming for a particular reason. It might be they have digestive issues, or it might be they have Hashimoto's, you know, autoimmune thyroid condition, or maybe they have multiple sclerosis or another autoimmune condition, or maybe their hormones are out of balance. And so in the functional medicine model, our goal is always to get to the root cause of the problem. And so nutrition is almost always one of the first things that we look at. And assuming they're doing the basics right, you know, going back to that basic human template that we talked about, eating nutrient-dense, anti-inflammatory foods, from there, we will use the lab tests that we do. For example, we'll check their thyroid levels, we'll check their nutrient levels, we'll check to make sure that they're getting enough of all of the nutrients that we know they need to function optimally. And if they're not, we'll look at their diet and we'll make adjustments and suggestions. For example, maybe you need to eat more organ meats or shellfish because those are extremely nutrient dense foods. Maybe you need to add some sea vegetables because you're not getting enough iodine. Maybe you need to add some whole food sources of calcium if you're not getting enough of that. So we'll look at the nutrients and make sure they're getting enough of all of those. And then we'll consider everything from addressing a particular condition that we've identified in the testing process. So an example might be SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, where you get an inappropriate overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestine, which is where food is absorbed. So we might then shift or tweak the diet a little bit to be less likely to feed that bacteria in the small intestine. Or if someone, again, has Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, a woman, for example, who is working full-time, has a few kids, is doing CrossFit a few times a week, is only getting maybe 6 hours of sleep, and she's been on a ketogenic diet, we're likely to take her off that because we know that the ketogenic diet, although it's a powerful therapeutic tool, is not appropriate in every circumstance. And in that case, it can put additional stress on someone that's already really burning the candle at both ends. So, you know, we start with underlying health conditions and then we look at goals. You know, if the person wants to lose weight, that will be a different diet choice than if the person wants to build muscle or endurance. So it's kind of a function of the causes and the goals.
When you're thinking about personalization and diet trends, can you think of a trend or something that's very popular right now that a lot of people think is healthy? And it could be, but it could also be something that's not the right fit for somebody else. It could be a food. And I know you gave a couple mm-hmm. examples with the ketogenic. Is there something else that comes to mind that often, you know, you guys run laboratory testing here. Somebody might think that they're doing the right thing on the outside, But when it comes to what their tests reveal, it actually could be something that's hindering their progress when it comes to their goals.
I think a vegan diet is probably the first one that comes to mind.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, so, if you watched What the Health,
right?
You'd think that the vegan diet is the cure to climate change.
Everything.
And also...
And hangnails.
Hangnails. And also better erections, yeah. According to the documentary.
Yeah. And it's not just What the Health. There's so many documentaries now about vegan diet. It's really gaining in popularity, and there's a lot of celebrity influence, and it definitely, it seems like it's picking up quite a bit of steam, which is concerning to me, because there are certainly some people who can thrive on a vegan diet. Rich Roll comes to mind. I've mentioned him on other podcasts. He's a super athlete, great guy. I've met him a couple of times. I really like him a lot. And it's clearly working for him, right? He's out there running centuries and like just killing it. So, I don't agree with some people who claim that a vegan diet can never work for somebody. There are examples of people that it's working for, but I would say they're probably more the exception than the rule in my experience. I actually do have quite a few patients who either come to me as vegans or were former vegans. I'm a former vegan myself, as a matter of fact.
Almost like we're at a confessional support group.
I was a macrobiotic vegan, which is in some ways even more extreme. I did raw food veganism for a while. And I'm also sensitive to the ethical and environmental considerations. I share those concerns. They're important to me. I've just arrived at a different conclusion for how to address them. But the main thing with the vegan diet comes down to nutrient density and the bioavailability of nutrients, which is unfortunately never addressed in these films that are made about the vegan diet. I wish there was fact checking for films in the same way that there is for articles that are published online, but there isn't.
Well, a lot of articles are not fact checked either.
That's true too. That's true too. Fortunately, ours are, but when you see a film, it can be very persuasive depending on who's delivering the information and whether people trust that person or have a relationship already, if it's an actor or a celebrity. But nobody's there checking, saying, hang on a second, wait, is that really true?
So I'd love to jump in with one of those claims that I've seen and I've repeated many times, also being a former, I don't know if you know, but I used to have the largest raw food website on the internet.
No, I didn't.
And we would publish recipes and articles and before and afters and everything like that. And I would say, well, look at a gorilla. Look how strong a silverback gorilla is.
Yeah.
And it doesn't eat any meat.
Yeah.
And so you often see that in these films that are there, and you think like, wow, okay, I guess it's right. Like, human beings don't need meat or fish or animal proteins to develop really strong muscles and to thrive. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable how you can make that argument, but it's unfortunately just misplaced. Gorillas eat for most of their waking hours.
They're chewing all day long.
They're chewing all day long because they have to break down the tough fibrous, material that they're getting in the foods that they eat. And they have a completely different, well, not completely different, but quite different physiology in terms of the length of their small intestine versus their large intestine. And humans' digestive anatomy is actually closer to that of a carnivore than it is to another primate or an herbivore. We have a larger small intestine because that's where nutrients are absorbed from animal products that we might eat. And we have a shorter colon, which is where a lot of that fibrous material would be broken down and nutrients are reabsorbed there. So you have to look at the anatomy and the physiology of the animal. And I think comparisons between humans and other species are not really that relevant.
They're often tough because, again, when you're high level and you're making a film, you don't see all the details in it. And you don't see that, well, there's a lot of data about how our brains evolved and how cooking allowed us to have smaller teeth and other factors inside of that. I want to actually take one more step back and say, on a personal level, I mean, my preference was to stay vegan and I just didn't feel good. And a few things were showing up for me. So when you were talking about being macrobiotic vegan and when you were talking about being, you know, exploring with raw foods, what happened that you started to shift? What was going on in your journey?
So I was already, I had become ill when I was traveling, you know, in Indonesia with parasites and digestive illness. That's kind of what brought me to this, well, be in this seat with you here. This was many, many years ago now. And so I was searching for solutions to that, and I had come across the idea of a vegan and macrobiotic vegan diet as one thing that I could do to help. But it actually took me in the other direction. I felt worse rather than better. I was fatigued. I was bloated all the time. Had, you know, worse digestive issues. My performance in terms of exercise tolerance and recovery was dropping like a rock. My libido was dropping like a rock. And I kept doing it because I am the kind of person that sticks with things. So, you know, I'm going to give it like the 100% try before I let go. And I believed in it because I had, you know, at that time was, it was consistent with what I was looking at. I had people around me who were doing it with great results. And I think it's really easy to fall into a kind of groupthink or consensus paradigm where if it's not working, it must be my fault, you know, something that I'm not doing well, rather than the problem with the approach. And I stuck with it probably longer than I should have. And I see that in friends and colleagues and patients as well. Because veganism can become a bit of an ideology above and beyond just a nutritional choice. And then, because it's not just a question of food, it's also tied in with the, you know, environmental arguments, ethical arguments. There's a lot more to it than just what do you eat? And that's, you know, way beyond the scope of the show today to talk about. But I think the biggest issue with the vegan diet that is missed on these films, and this is my pet peeve. I don't see any way of changing it. But films like that, and even videos on YouTube, and even many podcasts struggle with nuance and the finer, subtler details that actually are where the rubber meet the road and make all the difference in the world, but are difficult to communicate in certain formats, like a short YouTube clip or even a popular documentary style film. So I'll give you one example.
Please.
There's a concept called bioavailability, which just means how available are the nutrients in a food to digest and absorb. And often people are surprised to know that it's nowhere near 100% for any food. Even the most nutrient-dense bioavailable foods, you're not absorbing 100% of the nutrients that you see on a label. So if you see raw spinach, for example, you buy raw spinach and you go look it up on nutrition data, you'll see that it has a lot of calcium. Great, I'm going to eat spinach to meet my calcium needs. What you don't see is that a lot of that calcium in the spinach is not absorbed because of another compound that spinach has called oxalic acid, which really inhibits calcium absorption. So you're eating the spinach, but you're only getting about 20 or 30% maybe of the calcium that is on paper, so to speak. Whereas calcium from dairy products, for example, or from bone-in fish, you might eat canned salmon with the bones in, you're going to get a lot more of the calcium from those sources because it's much more bioavailable. And this is not just true of calcium. It's true of nearly every nutrient. Heme, iron, for example, iron found in animal products is significantly more bioavailable than iron in plant foods, which is why many vegetarians and vegans are low in iron. The same is true for zinc. The same is true for omega-3 fatty acids. So in flaxseed, walnuts, which are some popular vegan sources of omega-3 fats, you get alpha-linolenic acid, which is a precursor to EPA and DHA, which are the long chain omega-3 fats that have so much research behind them in terms of the benefits to brain health, heart health, anti-inflammatory. Those are the EPA and DHA are what really give us the benefit, not alpha-linolenic acid. Now, vegans will argue that you can convert alpha-linolenic acid into EPA and DHA, so there's no problem. But the fine print, again, the nuance is that we convert only about 0.5% of the alpha-linolenic acid that we eat from things like flax seeds and walnuts to DHA, which is the final product. And the even finer print is that that conversion depends on several different enzymes that work in that conversion process along the way. And those enzymes all require various nutrients to function properly, many of which are low in a vegan diet. So you can get a double whammy effect where someone is only consuming the precursor fats and they're low in some of the nutrients required to make the, that enzymatic conversion. So they don't even get that 0.5% of alpha-linolenic acid being converted into DHA. So that's hard to communicate
in a
documentary or an Instagram post or whatever, even a podcast.
I mean, even a
podcast. You're gracious to listen to that. But you can see how that would be very important, right? Because that makes all the difference in the world. If someone is eating something, assuming that it will be converted into the nutrient that they need, and it's not, then that can lead to problems down the line. And this is where I think this is what explains largely why one person can do well with a vegan diet and another person, you know, indefinitely, like your Rich Rolls, so to speak, and other people can get sick within months or even weeks. And the reason for that is that vegan diets tend to be high in precursor nutrients that are not not necessarily the most active forms of those nutrients. So I just use the example of ALA to DHA, but there are others like beta carotene is a precursor to retinol, which is the active form of vitamin A. And vitamin K1 is a precursor to vitamin K2, which is a different form of vitamin K that we now know is very important for heart health and bone health. And in addition to those enzymes in the conversion process requiring certain nutrients, there are also genes that affect the expression of those enzymes or proteins, which are, you know, enzymes or proteins. So for example, if you have genes that make you really good at doing those conversions, you could eat those precursor nutrients and yes, you can get plenty of the active nutrients just from eating those precursor nutrients. Whereas if I have genes that mean that I'm not very good at making those conversions, then I will end up being deficient in those active nutrients. And so you win, I lose on the vegan diet. Another example is I mentioned beta carotene. If you've ever seen people with orange palms that are doing like a carrot juice cleanse, I mean, you must have in your old days.
I definitely have. And anybody who's read like Steve Jobs' biography knows that, you know, there's a story instead of there of like him drinking a ton of carrot juice and showing up and being all orange.
Right. So I suspect I read that too. Some people actually convert no beta carotene into retinol, the active form. So people who either don't convert any or who have very poor conversion of beta carotene to retinol are the people who end up with the orange hands. And that's actually can be a sign that you are not going to convert that precursor into that active nutrient. So this is the biggest issue with the vegan diet, because when you look on paper, you can say, oh, okay, well, it's actually pretty good. You know, you can assemble different plant foods to get enough iron and get enough calcium, get enough zinc. But when you're missing out on the bioavailability part of that story, you're going to be misled. And I think that's what often happens.
And, you know, you were mentioning that when you were on the vegan diet, you weren't feeling well, but you were very much about sticking to an idea and a concept.
Yeah.
You couldn't have convinced me not to be on a vegan diet. I was just not interested in hearing it.
Sure.
I grew up in the Jain community, half of my tradition. And my mother's side, my tradition from my dad's side is the traditional Hindu Brahmin community is the sort of religious and philosophy group that I was born into. And I grew up vegetarian.
Yeah.
And so to me, once I found out about veganism, that just felt like the natural step. And I was very much about, as you mentioned, the environmental animal components. And I still do care about those things, but not in a million years would I listen to anything that anybody had to say. But what was there for me and what came up for you earlier is I actually did really well on a vegan diet until I didn't.
Right.
So I was on a vegan diet for about 6 years, and minus the fact that I was just, it was extremely difficult to nearly impossible to keep on any weight for me specifically. And I've seen that that's not the issue for other people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I was very thin to the point that my family would be quite worried. My friends would be quite worried. And the main reason that I went for a vegan diet is that I got rid of dairy, and I saw that in a 2 month period of time, my acne completely cleared up. Mm-hmm. I had grown up with a lot of antibiotics and inflammatory foods, and I was a very unhealthy vegetarian. And then when I had first gone down the vegan pathway and raw foods, my brain felt like it would fire on all cylinders. And about 6 years in, something changed, and I just felt like I could not muscle up any brain power. And my digestion started to become off, and I felt slow, and I genuinely felt very weak. And that was the only time for me that I started to ask questions of like, okay, is there something better out there, or am I doing something wrong? So for anybody who's listening, and this is not an episode to bash on the vegan diet or anything else like that, we're just talking about that as an example. If somebody is vegan right now, and we're very much encouraging maybe the larger motivations and the values of why they want to do it, what are some of the things that they can be asking themselves to check in of whether or not this diet or any diet is working for them?
Yeah, I think the story you told is a great example, because that I think that's how it works for most people. You know, I probably, because of my health conditions that I had at the time, and I think I am one of the people who has genes that mean I don't convert those precursor nutrients well, I learned more quickly that it wasn't working for me. But your experience is probably a little more typical. And I think the tricky thing about that is that when you had so much success with something initially, and later you start to feel bad, for many people, it's not the first thing to think of, oh, maybe it's the diet, because they had such a good results from doing it initially. They
might even healed you from something.
Yeah, they don't even question that it could be, that could be the problem. They might look elsewhere, you know, is it something else, you know, heavy metals or, you know, some other thing that's making me feel bad now rather than a diet. Because the body stores nutrients. And so it can take months or even years to develop deficiencies to a level that will be apparent to you, subjectively noticeable in your experience, like all of the symptoms that you mentioned. You probably were developing subclinical deficiencies before you even realized it. But by the time you're actually realizing it, they're substantial enough to be causing a problem. So look, I'm not dogmatic about this at all. As I said, I was a vegan myself. I didn't ever want people telling me what diet I should eat then and judging me for my dietary choices at that point. I still don't want that now. And I respect people's choices in this way. And you know, I have patients now who are vegans, and I don't try to talk them out of being a vegan. If they're coming to me for help, which they are, I do share like, okay, here are your labs. Here's like what I'm seeing in terms of nutrient deficiencies. I suspect this is being caused by your diet. And then I say, how do you want to address that? Do you want to change your diet, or do you want to keep your diet the same and for me to work with you with supplementation? You know, some people choose to start eating some animal products, very targeted, minimal amount of, and I help them to, you know, what would be the best choices there to get the most bang for your buck. For example, shellfish are incredibly nutrient dense. If you look at charts of the most nutrient dense foods, at the very top, you're going to see organ meats and shellfish. So if someone is willing to add some animal foods to their diet, I'll say eat 3 to 6 ounces of liver a week and a couple servings of oysters. That person could actually get more nutrients than someone who's eating only like boneless, skinless chicken breast or lean steaks on a kind of paleo type of diet, because the organ meats and the shellfish are so nutrient dense. So if they're willing to do that in a kind of medicinal way, of course, they're not a vegan anymore. So that, you know, but if they want to maintain mostly a vegan diet and just add those things in for their health and nutrition, then that's one possibility.
Could I interrupt with one sure. thing? Is this, do you feel like this is in some way, you know, the book, The Blue Zones, we just had Anakad O'Connor interviewed right before you, probably released the week before this podcast. And he wrote an article about modern day hunter-gatherer societies and the range in their type of diets, that some are high meat, some are low carb. But especially when it came to the Blue Zones, you know, they eat mostly plant foods, at least in the way that it's presented inside the book. And there's some small amount of animal foods in there, minus Loma Linda, California.
Yeah.
Is this part of your thinking too, that a lot of these societies is that they weren't vegetarian and they definitely weren't vegan, but they had a small amount of targeted amount of animal foods in there and a lot of plant foods, and that's what was making up the difference?
I think it varies, but in some cases, yes, I think that was probably true. It's, you know, most hunter-gatherer cultures ate the whole animal. So the nose to tail is, you know, fortunately making a bit of a comeback on the culinary scene. You see more restaurants now where you can go in and get the, all the different cuts of meat and an animal. And even though our ancestors didn't know anything about nutrients, or they weren't doing lab tests and checking for foods to see how much nutrients each had, they knew somehow intuitively through experience that the different parts of the animal had different nutrients that were really valuable. And so, you know, this, the trend that we have today is to eat mostly the muscle meat. So that's your steaks and your chicken breasts and things like that. And they're still very nutrient dense foods, but they're not nearly as nutrient dense as, for example, the organs or shellfish or things like this. So, you know, and then, the collagen or gelatinous tissues that we make broth with. This is why bone broth has, you know, made a resurgence and become so popular again, because it contains glycine, which is a very important protein for joint health and skin that is not well represented in lean muscle meats and proteins. So there is a way, you know, going back to your question, for someone who has been vegan, who wants to add some targeted animal foods back into their diet for nutrition, but continue, you know, for the other 90% of their food intake to maintain that basic vegan template, and I think to do very well. So that's one option. Another option, of course, is supplementation. So I think virtually every vegan should be taking B12. There are no plant sources of bioavailable B12 that can satisfy the need for B12 in a diet. Unfortunately, there are a lot of myths out there in the vegan community about this, that things like spirulina and yeast and other foods contain B12. They actually contain cobamides, which are analogs of B12 that don't perform the same functions of B12 and can actually block the uptake and absorption of true B12. So, you know, taking a B12 supplement is a very good idea. But then maybe seeing a functional medicine practitioner and getting some lab testing to see what your iron levels are, your zinc levels, your EPA and DHA levels, your calcium levels are, and then taking the appropriate supplements as required, or even making tweaks to the diet to try to get more of those particular nutrients in. And then I guess the last thing I would say is, if all of that's still not working, then you know, maybe also a good idea to see a practitioner and talk it out a little bit more, because there may be other things that are, you know, GI issues that are inhibiting the absorption of nutrients, or other problems that need to be evaluated. And then ultimately, it sometimes does come down to a really hard choice, you know, where people have to choose between their dietary ideals or preferences and their own health and well-being. And I, you know, that's not an easy choice to make.
You know, we've been talking about vegan, but of course, even if people are not vegan and they're eating the standard American diet and getting meat inside of there, they can have tons of nutritional deficiencies and challenges and other things. And one of the things that you talk about in your book, The Paleo Cure, is you really introduce this idea of like ancestral diet. So, and and what we can learn from the ancestral diet and what we can learn from looking back in our evolution of food. So what is the ancestral diet, and why is it so important to us to pay attention to?
Yeah, so the ancestral diet is just a kind of catch-all term for the diet of our ancestors. And that could be our ancestors 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 30,000 years ago, or even a million years ago. When you look at those diets, what you see that they share in common is, again, they consisted of some combination of meat and fish, wild fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, and some starchy plants, tubers, you know, root vegetables, potatoes, sweet potatoes, those kinds of things. And we also see what they shared in common is they didn't have a lot of sugar, industrial seed oils, other processed and refined foods that come in a bag or a box, which actually comprise the majority of calories that Americans are eating today, and probably most people in any industrialized society. 60% now of the calories in the industrial world come from ultra-processed food, not just processed food, ultra-processed food. So these are, you know, things like cookies and cakes, crackers, bread, sugar-sweetened beverages, et cetera. And the problem with these foods relative to the ones that we have been eating for most of our evolutionary history is that they're incredibly dense in calories, but lacking in nutrients. And they are also inflammatory. Whereas our ancestral diet is exactly the opposite. The foods are naturally very high in nutrients. They're naturally low in calories, and they're naturally anti-inflammatory. So the ancestral diet is just the one that our bodies are hardwired for. And to use a computer analogy, it's like, you know, we have this certain hardware and it's meant to run certain software. And that ancestral diet is the software that our bodies do well with. And now in this modern world that we live in, we have this new software that is completely incompatible with our hardware. And this is why you see the dramatic and alarming rise in chronic disease that we have today.
So most people that listen to this podcast know that, you know, we want to stay away from ultra processed foods. Within that category of the ancestral diet, going back to this larger debate about what's the right way to eat, there's a lot of questions in terms of how much fat should I have? How much carb should I have? Is the keto approach the right way? Is this the right way? So when you meet somebody who's just totally confused and is trying a lot of different things, and let's say they're not in the category of they have a specific problem. They're not coming to you with a specific thyroid issue or gut issue. They're just trying to eat the best way to feel good. And how can they begin to go down that path of personalizing once they removed processed foods for work that they know that don't work for them?
Thing I would say is, I think the biggest, just at, you know, taking a step back before I answer that question specifically, probably the biggest mistake we've made in nutritional science and this exploration of what diet is best is that we've been focused on macronutrient or food quantity rather than quality. So the idea has been that a carbohydrate is a carbohydrate, whether it comes from a sweet potato or a carrot or, you know, pizza. And that fat is a fat, whether it comes from soybean oil in a candy bar or whether it comes from an avocado or even MCT oil. That's clearly preposterous, but that's actually what the research assumed for many years. And then that's how you ended up with diets like Atkins, which were low carb. And that meant you could eat all kinds of highly processed, low carb packaged foods that Atkins Corporation was willing to sell you. And that the idea was that's fine because at least you're just not eating carbohydrates. It doesn't matter what the fats are and the quality of the fats. You're not eating carbohydrates. So that's, you know, that's fine. And it does work to some extent. You know, it might provoke weight loss, but what's it doing to the rest of the body? So I think that's the one thing I'd love everyone to take away from this, is that it's really about quality, not quantity. And there have actually been studies that have shown this. Some of the newer studies, better done studies, there was one out of Stanford where they took people, they put them on diets to lose weight. One group followed a low carb diet and the other group followed a low fat diet, but both diets were made up of real foods. And both groups lost weight compared to the control group that was eating the standard American diet. But there wasn't that big of a difference in between the two, the low carb and the low fat group. And that's just a great example of how it's really more about the quality of food that we eat than the quantity of macronutrients. Now, having said that, it's also certainly true in my experience that some people will do better on a lower carb, you know, real food diet, and some people might actually do better, although these are in the minority in my experience, on a lower fat, real food diet. And so in my book, my first book, The Paleo Cure, I argued that a good starting place for most people would be about somewhere between 20 to 25% of the diet as carbohydrate. More than that, perhaps, if you're really a highly active person, like an athlete, maybe about 20% to 25% protein. Again, like the higher range, if you're an athlete and you're working out a lot, lower, 15 to 20% if you're just going for general health. And then the rest is fat, healthy whole food fats like avocado, coconut, olive oil, olives, tree nuts, etc. And see how you feel. And if that's working for you, great. And if you have certain other goals like weight loss, for example, you might shift more towards the low carb end of that spectrum. So you might drop the carbohydrate intake below 25%, go down to 20 to 15%. You might increase the protein a bit, because protein is the most satiating macronutrient that we eat. It means it helps us feel satisfied. So it's more likely to lead to weight loss. Whereas if you, again, are an athlete and you're training hard, and not even a professional athlete, you know, you're just doing really glycolytic activities like CrossFit or weightlifting or explosive martial arts or anything that's explosive, then eating more like 30 or even 40% of your calories as carbohydrate could be a better fit for that person. Somebody who has Hashimoto's or a thyroid condition, fasting or low carb diet sometimes can reduce the conversion of T4 to T3 because insulin is used and is required for that conversion. And if you're on a really low carb or keto diet, or you're fasting a lot, your insulin will be very low, which is good for blood sugar, but maybe not great for thyroid. So in that case, they might want to add a few more carbohydrates. Or if someone's feeling really low energy or fatigued, or they're not sleeping well and they've been doing a low carb diet, sometimes adding some carbohydrate back can be helpful.
And I think that the other aspect of this that's there is, of course, there's what you eat and there's also when you eat. So when it comes to personalizing when you eat, everything from how many meals a day to this term intermittent fasting, that's become very popular. How do you help people navigate that? And what are some basic, generally regarded as safe recommendations? And how can people personalize off of that?
Yeah, there's some great new research that's come out on all of these questions. I think I'm pretty persuaded at this point, both from the research, from my own personal experience and my work with thousands of patients, that there is a lot to this idea of our circadian biology and timing our meals to match best with our circadian rhythms. And one thing that's important is having an overnight fast of at least 12 hours. That could go up to 16 hours if someone's doing intermittent fasting, which I'll come back to in a moment. But having a good 12-hour period where we're not taking in food or any other beverages other than, you know, water or clear beverages, I think is really important for helping our gut to reset, helping some cleanup and repair processes get started in the body that only happen when we're in the fasted state, and helping to regulate our circadian clock, which in turn regulates something like 20% of genes and controls gene expression of 20% of the genes in our body. So I think there's a lot of research that supports that. But unfortunately, if you look at the data, most Americans and most, again, people in the industrialized world are not doing that. So I think that's one of the first things someone can do to improve their health in terms of meal frequency and timing. Then if you want to extending that benefit a little further, you can use an approach called intermittent fasting, which you referred to. And there's a lot of different ways that that can be done. Some people like alternate day fasting where they don't eat one day and then they eat the next day. I think the most effective and user-friendly way is what some people call 16-8, where you fast for 16 hours and then you compress all of your food intake into an 8-hour window in the day. So let's say you could eat all of your meals between 12 noon and 8 p.m. and then you wouldn't eat anything between 8 p.m. and noon the next day. Or you could vary the timing and do it, you know, from 10 to 6 or even 9 to 5. From the perspective of our circadian rhythm, it's actually better to eat earlier in the day. So you eat your meals from 8 to 4 and then have, you know, a long stretch in the evening without eating and go to bed. That's best for us physiologically, but it's not very good for your social life. If you want to be able to go out to dinner with friends or have dinner with your family or whatever, it's quite inconvenient. And I think those things are important. Actually, it's the social connection is crucial for human beings, and many people aren't getting enough of it. So I don't try to talk my patients into doing it that way because they're more to health than food, and we have to keep those other things in mind. But
of course, and I know when it comes to time restricted eating and the different times you choose, I found for myself, you know, I grew up in the Indian tradition, and occasionally on like special occasions, I might see my parents do a full day fast or only have certain ceremonies or holidays, it might be you only eat at night. But for the vast majority, fasting was always something that they did in the evening. If they were going to skip a meal, it wasn't going to be breakfast.
Right.
And so when the intermittent fasting thing became a lot more popular before even some of the work of like Walter Longo and some of those individuals, I thought, okay, let me start trying to miss out on breakfast. And I've been in entrepreneurs, the only thing I've done, I've had one job when I was in high school, and I would find that my brain could not think when I did not eat breakfast. And while I know that that works for a lot of people and they say, they swear by it, if I miss, I do best when I eat first thing in the morning and then I can skip dinner later on. And that's what feels best to me. And again, that's just an example of personalization and people trying things out, but just because something's a trend, not to follow along those lines and see what actually works for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. And still others, I mean, this is often hard for people to do with their schedules too. It works better for people who work at home, for example, or have control of their own schedules. But a lot of my patients who are in that bucket do well eating like a late breakfast at like 10 or brunch, if you will, and then an early dinner at like 5 or 6, especially if they have young kids and they're eating early. And they just skip the lunch part. And that actually works well for their, like if they get really busy at work and they're working on a project, they don't want to have to stop and eat lunch. And so that can work really well too. And I find myself doing that fairly regularly as well. So yeah, there's no one size fits all approach.
So let's say somebody wanted to try that. They wanted to try eating at 10. You know, they've been playing around with intermittent fasting and time-restricted eating, and I know everybody has different definitions for stuff, but they wanted to eat their first meal at 10 and then eat an early dinner at 5. How long would they give that a shot to notice the effects of how they felt? And what should they be looking out for to see if this is working or not working for them?
Yeah, so it depends on the person, actually. I unfortunately, that's my answer to everything.
No,
please. Just the reality of how it goes. But some people can adapt to that quite quickly. And other people, it might take a full 3 weeks to get fully adapted to that intermittent fasting. Because you start in that fasted state, you start to produce ketones. And that is part of what the benefit is to that approach. And then also some processes like autophagy, which is a cellular cleanup and repair process, can get going when you've been fasting for a certain period of time. But we know from research that the amount of time it takes for ketone production to start, or the carbohydrate threshold, or the fasting amount of hours you have to be in a fasted state before ketones start getting produced, varies from person to person. So that explains why some people can switch to that and feel great right away. For other people, they have what some have coined like the low carb flu or the fasting flu, where they feel kind of like flu-like symptoms, almost like achy and tired and just not themselves. That's not a reason to stop. A lot of people do stop then, but generally those symptoms will only last for maybe 3 to 5 days, and then they'll start to, you know, people will kind of level out and feel normal again. And then after another few days, they'll start to actually feel a lot better. So I would say 3 weeks is the, if you're still not feeling good or better after 3 weeks, then it's probably not going to work for you.
Is there anybody that really wouldn't benefit from fasting, or is in certain scenarios, is dealing with certain conditions that even though fasting is all the trend and everybody swears by it and there's all this literature, that maybe they could consider taking a step back in the short term to help long-term aspects?
Absolutely. So important thing to understand about fasting is that it's what we call a hormetic stressor. So hormesis is a positive adaptation that happens in the body. You know, we tend to think of stress as bad, and certainly too much stress is bad, but stress is what provokes evolution. Without any stress, our bodies don't evolve. And so an example of this that everyone's familiar with is exercise. So if you go to the gym and you lift a heavy weight until failure, you know, where you can't do another repetition, the muscle tissue basically is tearing down in that situation. And so the body, what it does is it will rebuild that muscle tissue to be stronger in order to meet that demand in the future. Because from an evolutionary perspective, if we face some challenge that we weren't able to cope with, that would be a threat to our survival, right? So the body's going to try to respond in a way that helps us to evolve and grow to meet that future challenge to protect our survival. You know, we're really just still running on this same evolutionary programming. And now we're lifting weights in the gym instead of running away from a lion or, you know, trying to lift something heavy to build a shelter, but it's the same, our body runs in the same way. So fasting, a lot of the benefits that you get from fasting are from this kind of hormetic response, where the body is doing this cleanup and repair, and it's certain processes are being upregulated from this kind of positive stress. So imagine, going back to the example I used earlier, a mom who has 2 or 3 kids. She is working full time. She's doing CrossFit a few times a week. She's got Hashimoto's or some other health condition. She's getting like 5 or 6 hours of sleep a night. She already has a very high background level of stress. And so in that situation, if you add an additional stressor, it could really push her over the edge. And, you know, compare that with someone who, again, is maybe mostly sedentary, they're overweight, they're getting enough sleep. I'm sure they've got some stress in their life. Everybody has some, but they're not doing, strenuous exercise or have all of these other stressors in their life, and they add fasting, that can produce fantastic results. So those are two examples of, you know, someone who might really benefit and someone who might not benefit. And so one easy way to think about it is just kind of assessing your overall stress level. Like the more, if you've got like a really significant chronic health condition that has depleted your energy levels, if you're already very tired, if you're already not sleeping very well, you're in a really stressful life situation, like you have really big crisis going on at work or in your relationships, you might want to be a little cautious with intermittent fasting, or certainly every day, you know, maybe once or twice or 3 times a week, but not every day. If, on the other hand, that's not the case, then maybe you can be a little more aggressive with that approach.
So I want to talk about laboratory testing. As a functional medicine practitioner in your clinic here and other practitioners that work there, what are some examples of personalization that can only come from laboratory testing? And how can we provide some guidance for people of how far they can go on their own versus when they need to tap into testing to help them go a little bit deeper? Mm-hmm. We'll talk specifically in terms of diet.
Yeah. So I'm actually a big believer that most people can do everything they need without getting testing. It might seem strange to hear a functional medicine practitioner say that.
I know that's your viewpoint, so that's why I wanted you to talk about it a little bit.
I think, you know, getting like really dialing in the nutrient density is super important for most people, and just making sure that your intake of nutrients is sufficient. And, you know, experimenting in the way that we've talked about with things like macronutrient ratios, how much protein, fat, and carbohydrate to eat, and then also experimenting with meal frequency and timing. If someone is really motivated and on top of all of that, they can make phenomenal progress on their own, or with the support of a health coach, for example, is another way to do it. However, inevitably, some people run up against a wall. You know, they've done all of this work and they're still not feeling great, or they're just really confused by all of the conflicting information out there. I think many of us are suffering from information overload. And in those situations, I think it can really pay off to see a functional medicine practitioner who can do some labs and use those lab results to help guide the nutrition choices. And not just the lab results, but like I have, you know, like Mark, I know, you know, very extensive case review intake paperwork where I'm asking all kinds of questions about their lifestyle, their goals, their health status, their health history, their genes and genetic results if they have them. And then I'm tailoring my recommendations based on that. So it's not just lab testing. It's also like a very thorough intake and health history, which I think is underrated often in medicine. And there's no time for that in the conventional model in a 12-minute appointment. But so, you know, one example would be blood testing for nutrient status. I do this with every patient that walks in the door. And, you know, I frequently will find iron deficiency that's, you know, manifesting in anemia, which can cause a lot of problems. I find B12 or folate deficiency can be common, which can lead to high homocysteine levels. I'll sometimes find deficiencies of magnesium or calcium, which can also lead to a lot of issues, zinc and copper, which are very important for brain function, especially, and immune function. And then this can help guide my recommendations, like, you know, eat some oysters, eat some organ meats, or eat some of these other foods that are rich in these nutrients so we can get your levels back up. Because a lot of us fall into kind of habitual patterns of eating. It's just normal. We like certain foods. We get accustomed to preparing foods a certain way. And one of the downsides of that is we might not actually be meeting our need for certain nutrients, and it can not necessarily be clear without that kind of testing if that's happening. So that's one example. Another example could be gut testing. So I mentioned SIBO before, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, a condition where you have too much bacteria in your small intestine and that's interfering with food absorption. In that situation, we might put someone on a particular diet for a period of time, perhaps a low FODMAP diet, which is low in certain types of carbohydrates that can feed the bacteria there. We might put them actually on a very low carb or ketogenic diet for the same reason. In extreme situations where other treatments have failed, we might even put that person on a kind of modified elemental diet or fasting kind of diet that consists of a formula that we use that's better than the typical elemental formulas that you get. So I would put that though more in the context of like therapeutic nutrition than like just nutrition for the person who's just trying to feel well and healthy.
And for some of these tests that you mentioned, of course, people can see a functional practitioner like yourself or the Ultra Wellness Center where our doctors are, or finding somebody local in their area. When you're talking about like blood work, can people get that done with their regular doctor?
It's possible in the sense that the doctor could order those tests if they wanted to. Does it happen very often? No. And that's in part a function of, insurance companies not wanting to pay for those tests because they're viewed as preventative. And geez, we don't want to spend money preventing a disease. We it's much rather just wait until that disease is full blown and far harder to treat. I mean, that seems to be the mentality of the insurance companies.
So it's the way that like our system is designed.
It's the way it's designed. So unfortunately, a lot of those tests are not typically run. And also the other issue is that most doctors don't actually receive training or education on how to interpret the nutrient-based test results or how to use nutrition therapeutically to address those problems. Registered dietitians and nutritionists are, but they're not always utilized in especially conventional practice.
And they may not always be on the up and up about even very basic things. Like, I'm so surprised how many times my friends might ask, hey, you know, just are they saying before they go and see a functional medicine practitioner, just take a look at my blood work in terms of what I've gotten done,
right?
Not analyzing the levels, but do you think that it's complete before I go see somebody? And I know I can get there. I'm always surprised how often like they're missing vitamin D and other basic things that just their doctor never ran on them.
Absolutely.
Before.
Yeah.
And so sometimes things are missing, or the nutritional science is getting updated every few years. And so what is considered optimal is not always what people are looking at when they think of the reference range.
The conventional dietetics training, unfortunately, has been unduly influenced by big food. The organizations that represent the dietetics field are heavily conflicted in terms of financial donations. You know, you go to like a diet, I know because I have registered dietitians on staff. I've worked with many of them. They tell me about the conferences that they go to that have, you know, Nestle and Coca-Cola and other big food companies exhibiting at these conferences and
paying for the lunches.
Yeah. If we think that that's not influencing nutritional policy, we're kidding ourselves. Mm. That's, you know, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. And so the low fat, high carbohydrate diet and the idea that like sugar is fine, but fat is bad for you, that has largely been supported by these big food companies. So that is another problem where someone might seek out the help of a conventionally trained dietitian that is still operating under that framework, and the recommendations they might get are probably not so helpful.
You mentioned gut testing, and there's been a boom and a surge of at-home gut testing kits and companies that claim that they can tell you what food sensitivities you have. And I'm always fascinated by this, and my hope is that we're there one day. But I look at the people that are seeing patients that I look up to, like yourself, Dr. Hyman, many hundreds of other practitioners, and I don't see them using one test to give the patient an answer on what it is that they're, how to like dial in their diet and how to personalize. What are your thoughts about these at-home tests, especially gut, as the microbiome has gotten big? And are they useful at all? Can they be dangerous? And how would you guide the listeners of this podcast?
Yeah, I think there's in the last few years, there's been a few new companies that are offering quantitative PCR technology, which, you know, I won't go into all the details there, but it's a much more accurate method of assessing the microbiome, the status of the microbiome. So we're already quite far ahead of where we were even 5 years ago, and certainly 15 or 20 years ago in our ability to assess that. But there are still some fundamental challenges. One is that when you test the stool, you're not actually assessing the levels of bacteria in the intestine itself. And that's very important because many of those bacteria play an even more important role in our gut health. So what you see in the stool is not necessarily what's in the gut. And there's no real way of resolving that at current time with stool tests. That's just a fundamental limitation of any kind of stool test. The second thing is that I think we are much better at collecting the data than knowing what to do with them. And so some of these newer tests, I feel like the data are great. It's awesome to see what we're collecting. But when we see the results, we're often just scratching our heads as clinicians because we don't actually know what a healthy microbiome is for an individual person. We know we can point to trends within populations. We can say in general, in the Western population, these trends or these patterns are associated with good health. And in general, these other patterns are associated with poor health. But those patterns can vary in different populations. So for example, in the Hadza hunter-gatherers in Africa, one of the few extant hunter-gatherer societies in the world, we tested their microbiome and found that they had low levels of bifidobacteria, which are pretty much considered to be one of the healthiest species
in all the probiotics in the
Western microbiome, right? So we see there even a difference between populations, and there's almost certainly now a lot of the microbiome scientists that I follow and respect are suggest that there's a kind of a thumb, you know, maybe like analogous to a fingerprint where there's a kind of individual microbiome that's healthy for you that might be a little bit different than what's healthy for me. Now, having said that, on these tests, we can sometimes detect extremes. Like we can see certain species of bacteria or even parasites that we know absolutely shouldn't be there and are never healthy for anybody. Or we can see really low levels of bacteria that are pretty universally considered to be beneficial. So at the extremes, I think it's helpful. But in terms of saying, Drew, you really should eat more strawberries and you should cut back on your spinach intake, which is what I see on some of these reports, I don't think we can do that at all. And look, I'd be the first person, I'd be climbing over everybody to get to a test that could tell me exactly what I should eat and my patients exactly what they should eat, but we're not there yet.
It seems that a vast amount of personalization, even if you are working with a functional practitioner or integrative doctor or somebody who knows a lot about the space, a vast majority of it is really the personal experimentations you have to run. Yep. Setting up the base and then trying stuff, which is really what your book is about. And there's so much there, so much more there in your book that we didn't get a chance to get into, which is like the degrees of personalization that come from seasonality, activity levels, other things. So that is a great resource. It came out a few years ago, The Paleo Cure.
Very end of 2013.
Yeah. 2013. Yeah. And so I would highly recommend people read that. I'm going to pivot away from the book and I'm going to conclude by going through some top health trends that are there right now that for good or better, we're seeing out there. And I want to get your hot take.
All right.
On these to conclude us out.
Let me guess. Carnivore.
Well, first we're going to have celery juice.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, look, I think for some reason, humans are kind of hardwired. Well, I know what the reason is actually. We're by nature, we're designed to conserve energy. So we seek the thing that has the big impact with the least amount of effort. And we're drawn to things that can potentially be gimmicky for that reason. I think celery juice certainly can be beneficial, but is it a miracle cure? Will it, you know, solve all of your problems? No. And I think most people are far better off addressing the basics that we've been talking about than they are looking for that superfood or that one or two things that they can do that will, you know, make everything better.
Yeah. And I've met Anthony, the medical medium who's popularized that. And I guess there's a lot of things that are out there that people could, you know, it's like, if it's working for you, amazing.
Yeah.
Right. And keep on doing it. And I'm sure there's great intentions behind it, but I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said that there's not one thing across the board that's just going to be that miracle cure.
And I have no problem with it as long as it's not going to cause harm.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see a lot of harm coming from celery juice overconsumption, so I'm not too worried about it. There are other situations where there is potential for harm, and I'm more concerned about those.
The next one I want to go to is sort of added saturated fat into our diet. And I would love to get your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that one's more complex because it really does depend on the person. And we, you know, I do genetic testing, advanced lipid testing on patients where I test their lipoprotein particle numbers. I test their genes that determine to some extent how much cholesterol and fat they absorb from the food that they eat. And we see big variations there. So for example, you know, one person might go on a low carb or even a ketogenic diet, and it might not affect their cholesterol or lipoprotein levels at all, or very minimally, might even go down. We certainly see that in many cases of people who have insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome, because in those cases, that's what's driving the high number of lipoproteins. However, you might see somebody else whose total cholesterol goes from 180 to 300 when they switch to a keto diet, and their LDL particle number goes from maybe 800 or 900 to 2500. And at least as far as we understand right now of the pathogenesis of heart disease, you want to keep those, you know, particularly the LDL particle number fairly low, because that is what, you know, those lipoproteins can initiate the process of plaque formation, which eventually leads to a heart attack. So this is where I always say there's no one size fits all approach. For somebody having bulletproof coffee where they're putting, you know, a lot of butter and MCT oil in the coffee and drinking it every day, might be fine. For somebody else, it actually conceivably could significantly increase their risk of heart disease. So that's where the testing, I think, can be really helpful.
You mentioned a genetic test. Of course, the particle size number, you got to work with a practitioner to really get that now. Are there any at-home genetic tests that you feel that help people dial in terms of fat? Or is that really the practitioner level?
Yeah, that's...
I'm familiar with the test called DNA diet, but it's only something that practitioners can run.
No, there's... this is more practitioner level stuff. And yeah, even then, there's only really one lab that I know of that's doing these advanced genetic tests that are related to our, you know, lipoproteins and the impact that they have on lipoproteins. There are many labs now that offer LDL particle number and HDL particle number, and the particle number is, you can get that through LabCorp for, well, it's called an NMR.
Particle size.
Yeah, it has the size, but also the number of particles, which is even more important. And there are slight differences in the methodology that different labs use, but I think if that's what's accessible, go for that. It's only about $70, even if you pay out of pocket from LabCorp. And if you can get your doctor to order it, it's a good starting place.
Well, we're going to keep it to those two trends.
We'll talk about carnivore another time.
Well, actually, you know what? Just toss it in. Like, give us a quick hot 1 minute take on a carnivore diet.
Okay. So I think it can, there's no doubt that it can help people tremendously. And the reason that I think that it's helping people is that it's dramatically limiting the amount of substrate or fiber that gets into the small intestine and feeds any kind of bad bugs that are there. And so in a way, I think about it as like the similar approach or similar benefit of fasting, because you're just really limiting the amount of food that gets into the gut. And it's a way of extending the benefits of fasting, because obviously you can only fast for a certain amount of time, right? But if you do carnivore, you can do that, you know, kind of indefinitely. But if you look at the... all of the ancestral human diets, they all contain some combination of plant and animal foods. If you look at from a biochemical perspective, plant foods have certain nutrients that you can't find in animal foods, and vice versa. So I think a combination of both plant and animal foods is best for humans.
Short term could help by not provoking a deeper underlying issue that's going on, but the question are what the long term implications
exactly
are.
Exactly. And that we really don't know yet.
Chris, thank you for coming on our podcast and talking all things personalization. You have some great trainings and other things. You know, we talked a little bit about health coaching, and you're a big advocate of that, as is Dr. Mark Hyman, and has health coaches at our practice and at the Cleveland Clinic as well too. Can you give a little plug for the health coaching program that you have coming up for anybody who's interested in going down that path?
Sure. Yeah, I know Dr. Hyman and I feel the same way about this. I think health coaching truly is the future of medicine, because as we've been spending the entire time talking about diet, nutrition changes, and things we can do to improve our health, most healthcare is self-care. which means that, you know, even if you see a functional medicine practitioner, you're only in the office maybe a few times a year for a half hour, sure. You know, right? And the other 99.99% of your life you're at home making choices about food and sleep and stress management and exercise. And so the biggest impact we can make is to support people in making the right choices in those areas. And doctors are not the people to do that. They don't have enough time. They don't have training in those areas, and there'll never be enough of them to support the number of people that we need to support. So health, that's the domain of a health coach. And that's why I'm so excited about it. And we have a 12-month certification program that is approved by the National Board of Health and Wellness Coaches, which is the leading international organization that sets the standard for education and training of health coaches, because it's really important to me to give people legitimate, credible certification, or that they can use to, you know, join a clinic like mine or like Dr. Hyman's and really be part of the professional healthcare community. And it's completely online. It's accessible. We've had students from 26 countries around the world go through it. And it's really phenomenal. I'm so, so passionate about it. And if people want to learn more, they can go to cresser.co/HCTP. That's Health Coach Training Program, HCTP. So they can go there to get more information. And then I also have a 12-month training program for functional medicine practitioners. So this is for doctors or nurse practitioners or other people with already have a professional healthcare license who want to incorporate functional medicine into their practice or start a completely separate functional medicine practice. And you can learn more about that at cresser.co/PTP. That's Practitioner Training Program, PTP.
Fantastic. And we'll put the link for those and the Paleo Cure in the show notes. Chris Cresser, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Drew. Pleasure.
Appreciate it. Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.